From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! This week, Congress will battle over repeal of the gas tax. Who benefits? We'll tell you which members are sponsored by the oil industry and why. We'll visit a grassroots group in Minnesota that's trying to change the relationship between money and politics.
Basically, our analysis of working at the legislature is there's two kinds of power. There's organized money and there's organized people. And obviously, we're not going to be organized money. We're trying to be organized people, and so one of the things we always are working on is educating, organizing, mobilizing people around issues.
And as the Green Party begins to get off the ground here in the United States, we'll talk to a founder of the German Greens about how they became a political force to reckon with. All this coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. When it comes to the abortion debate among Republicans, party chair Haley Barbour contends there's less here than meets the eye, and he'd like the divisive issue to drop out of sight completely. But that seems unlikely. In the past couple of weeks, the abortion debate has heated up as some prominent moderate Republicans, including Governors Pete Wilson of California, Kristi Whitman of New Jersey, George Pataki of New York, and William Weld of Massachusetts, said they wanted to amend the anti-abortion language in the party platform. At the same time, Senator Bob Dole supports the appointment of Illinois Republican Henry Hyde, who has strong anti-abortion credentials, as chair of the platform committee. In addition, the head of the Christian Coalition, Ralph Reed, for the first time suggested the party could rewrite its platform to remove a specific call for a constitutional amendment banning abortion. The events prompted Pat Buchanan, who remains in the GOP presidential race, to call on Dole to restate his support of the anti-abortion movement. But New York Senator Alphonse D'Amato, the co-chair of Dole's National Campaign Steering Committee, attacked Buchanan. In a speech this weekend to the Republican National Committee's Northeast Leadership Conference in Long Island, New York, D'Amato said Buchanan has been a divisive element in the party and has turned off mainstream voters. He said, "We have a guy running around who wants to exclude this one, that one, the other one, who beats up on women, beats up on gays, beats up on immigrants." D'Amato later said, "We should not march to some philosophical Ayatollah." Responding, Babe Buchanan, the candidate's sister and campaign chairwoman, said, "It would be my recommendation to Bob Dole to muzzle Senator D'Amato for the sake of the Republican Party." Just days before, D'Amato also had attacked Gingrich for pushing a strongly conservative agenda he says has hurt the party. And that's some of our abortion news roundup for this weekend. On the international front, while President Clinton basks in the glow of a U.S.-mediated Israel-Lebanon accord, a preliminary U.N. inquiry says Israel deliberately attacked the U.N. base in southern Lebanon, killing more than 100 Lebanese civilians. Its findings are based on a video that shows an Israeli reconnaissance aircraft flying over the base as it's being attacked. The presence of this drone was first reported on Democracy Now! Last Friday by British correspondent Robert Fisk in his debate with the New York Times Middle East bureau chief Serge Shmaiman. And the State Department released thousands of pages of documents to Congress on human rights abuses in Guatemala, including the case of Sister Diana Ortiz, the American nun who continues her silent vigil and fast outside the White House. She was raped and tortured in Guatemala and is demanding the Clinton administration release all documents in her case, as well as others. Meanwhile, the State Department denies her claim that an American man was in the room when she was tortured by the Guatemalan military. Sister Diana Ortiz is holding a news conference today outside the White House. Senate Majority Leader Robert Dole is expected to make a major foreign policy address this week. His differences with President Clinton? Leadership, he's expected to say. Well, we're going to talk about domestic issues today, a story that has come up in the last weeks, and that is the issue of the gas tax, always a little tough to say. The Democrats over the last weeks have been pushing for an increase in the minimum wage to counter the attention that the Democrats have been getting. The Republicans, led by Senate Majority Leader Robert Dole, have been pushing for repeal of the gas tax. Well, this week, the debate moves to the House of Representatives. Last Friday, the Senate Finance Committee heard from representatives of the trucking, bus, railroad, and airline industries, all supporting a repeal of the 4.3 cent per gallon tax passed as a part of President Clinton's 93 budget. But not present at the witness table, but very much players in the gas tax repeal debate, were representatives from the oil and gas industry. We're going to talk about who benefits from this gas tax repeal and which Congress members are receiving money from the oil and gas industry. Joining us is Nancy Watzman. She is project director of Cashing In, a project of the Center for Responsive Politics. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nancy.
Thank you.
So who does the gas and oil industry support in Congress?
Well, Senator Bob Dole, a presidential candidate, he received about $216,000 from the oil and gas industry in 95, and that puts him at the second highest recipient, following only Phil Gramm, who, of course, is from Texas and was also a presidential candidate.
Now, can you explain why this benefits the oil and gas industry, this push for a repeal of the gas tax?
Well, just basically anything, you know, that taxes the industry, they would see is cutting down on consumption. They want more consumption, therefore more profits. You know, they are a little bit coy about their position. Formally, they say that they oppose the gas tax, but only because it goes to the deficit reduction and instead of going to trust funds that help build highways, et cetera.
Well, I think it's interesting that Congressmember Dick Armey, the Republican leader of the House, has a suggestion for how to make up for the tax that would be cut by the Republicans, the gas tax, and he suggests cutting education spending.
That's right. That came out this morning that he's saying that that's one way to get back the revenue that the gas tax would brings in, you know, because it brings in about $4.8 billion a year to the Treasury.
What about President Clinton in terms of support from the oil and gas industry?
He also received money, but he received about $50,000 in comparison.
So about a fifth of what Senator Dole has received.
That's right. So it's you know, here again we see what happens in an election year where, you know, and it's not just Senator Dole. I mean, President Clinton does his share of this sort of thing as well, where they advance policy issues which, you know, are probably going to be favored by some of their big financial contributors, but try to present it in a populist light.
Now, something interesting in the past weeks, as Robert Dole has taken this on as his issue, the repeal of the gas tax, is that he supported taxes on gas and the increases in the past.
That's right, he did. I mean, that has come out. But again, this is an election year, and this is what goes on.
Now, in addition to coming out with your figures on who's getting money from the oil and gas industry, this week you put out a report on the top lobbyist contributors in Washington. Can you tell us who some of these people are?
Sure. We looked at the top 300 contributing lobbyists in Washington. These are the lobbyists for hire, the folks that work for firms that exclusively do this. And we found that altogether, these 300 top contributing lobbyists gave about $3.2 million in 1995 alone. It was about evenly split, the money they gave to Democrats and Republicans, if you look at it overall. But if you look at individual lobbyists, they tend to favor one party or the other, personally. Not all of them, but most of them.
I was interested in seeing the number one D.C. lawyer lobbyist donor of 95, C. Boyden Gray. Last year, when I was covering the first 100 days of Congress, he was the one who was fighting the FDA, representing, he said, small businesses, people who were trying to put forward new and novel ideas, and the FDA was taking a long time, you know, to pass, either to agree to allow products to be introduced or to veto them. C. Boyden Gray, who is he, and how much money has he given?
He gave almost $143,000 in 1995. And most of the money went to Republican Party committees. It also went to folks, you know, a range of folks, including a couple members of the Governmental Affairs Committee in the Senate who are very key to regulatory reform, which he cares very much about, as you mentioned, and also People like David McIntosh in the House, who are also very much leaders on that issue. And that FDA issue, actually, that you're talking about hasn't gone away. It's actually very current right now in Congress. They've been holding hearings. They've been trying to move a bill to revamp the whole way that the FDA reviews products and drugs.
Let's not forget that the head of the FDA is David Kessler, who is the arch nemesis of the tobacco industry, as he is expected any day now to say that nicotine tobacco is a drug and that it should be regulated by the FDA.
That's right. And, you know, if you look throughout our list, you also see other lobbyists, for example, who represent tobacco companies in one way or another. And they also are targeting contributions towards the people who are fighting against those kinds of proposals. There's a couple of bills out there right now that would prevent the FDA from being able to doing exactly what you just said.
Who is the number two lobbyist?
The number two lobbyist is Lawrence F. O'Brien III. He's very much a Democrat. His father used to be DNC chairman. And, you know, that's another thing I'd like to add. This list includes Democrats and Republican inclined people alike. He gave nearly $78,000. All of his money went to Democrats. And the interesting thing about him, really, is he works for a firm called O'Brien Kallio, and the Kallio in the title is Nicholas Kallio, who was the in the Congressional Liaison Office in the Bush White House. And together they have this firm, so they have a Democrat and a Republican. And Nicholas Kallio was very much present in all the dealings with the Contract with America last year and budget negotiations and so on. He was involved in all the kind of strategy planning meetings. So you have a case where you can have these two people who are both kinds of have connections in both parties build a lucrative business. Basically,
I see the number three top lobbyist donor in 1995 was a member of the Duberstein Group. Duberstein, who is also a Republican White House staff person.
That's right. The number three person was Stephen M. Champlin, who also very much identifies with the Democrats. He used to work for David Bonnier, the majority whip. And he also gave almost all of his money to Democrats.
I guess the real question that we have to ask now, and I guess it becomes apparent when you see the money going to the Democrats and Republicans, although the Republicans have made, at least in the congressional races, what, three times more, have raised three times more money now than Democrats, is this really does explain why both Senator Dole and President Clinton overall are opposed to real campaign finance reform. While they put forward different efforts President Clinton has in the past, there is no real follow-through. They're not interested in this.
And not only are they not interested in this, as you say, but they also, again, you see this kind of thing with the gas tax this week where they're pushing forward policies that favor particular political donors.
Like?
Such as the gas tax repeal.
I see your number 10 top lawyer lobbyist donor is Robert Thompson. And just earlier, we were reading some of the news election headlines of the weekend on Guatemala and Sister Diana Ortiz standing outside the White House demanding the information in her case. She was raped and tortured in Guatemala and other Guatemalans. And Robert Thompson has some interesting connections to the government of Guatemala.
Yes, he did represent the Guatemalan government in 1995, trying to improve its public relations image before Congress. They actually let him go earlier this year. There was actually a letter from the ambassador who, you know, that he sent to all the press saying that he didn't think that Mr. Thompson had done a very good job. But nevertheless, he was hired and retained for about $70,000 a month. And
maybe it was that Jennifer Harbury and Sister Diane Ortiz had done too good a job.
Well, that could be.
So he gives most of his money to the Democrats.
Yeah, he does. And it's interesting. I mean, he gave a lot of his money to people who would be opposed to what he was trying to lobby on. For example, he gave some money to Robert Torricelli, and he also gave a bunch of money to the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee.
That's interesting, considering Robert Torricelli, the New Jersey Democrat, who, by the way, is running for Senate now in a tight race, is the one who revealed to Jennifer Harbury the information that the Central Intelligence Agency was providing money to the Guatemalan military officer who is believed to have killed her husband.
That's right.
Tell us, these lobbyists that you have documented, and we'll let people know the phone number if they want to get a copy of this report and who these lobbyists are. Are there any restrictions on them giving money? Are they giving them on their own behalf or on the behalf of their groups?
Well, they have the same restrictions that any individual has placed upon them. They can give, as you or I could, they could give up to $2,000 to a particular candidate in a full election. They can give money to PACs. You know, they're not limited in any way that anybody else is limited. Whether this is their own money or not, you know, this is money that shows up at the FEC under their name. We can't really, you know, swear to where they get it.
Has the lobbying reform bill that the House passed, I guess, unanimously recently, has that changed anything in terms of what we know about lobbyists?
Well, it's still, I think, a little early to tell. We did look at these people. For this report, we actually included both registered lobbyists under the old law, but then also Washington-based lawyers on the assumption that a lot of those folks are doing lobbying and weren't captured by the definition of lobbying before. About 220 of these 300 people were registered under the new law, which is supposed to capture more people. We'll have to see. I mean, there's nothing, and you know, that's entirely a disclosure law. It has nothing to do with contributions.
I think it's interesting that of the top 10 lobbyists, most of them are giving money to the Democrats.
That's right.
C. Boyden Gray, number one. You have giving to the Republicans, but number two, number three, number four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, and 10 are all giving overwhelmingly to the Democrats.
That's right. And again, this is something that really it's not an ideology thing. I mean, they're people of both persuasions are giving and giving in a practical way.
Tell me, over this last week, as the gas tax repeal debate has been heating up, have you gotten many calls from the press asking about the amount of money that the oil and gas industry is pouring into this debate? Although they're not in the forefront, they're not the ones being asked to testify before Congress.
Yes, I mean, we've gotten some calls, but not as many as I would have expected, to be honest. Checked on that late Friday, and we've been getting some. I suspect we'll get a lot of calls this week.
It seems very difficult for the American people to understand what interests are behind what debate, because it's very carefully planned who will come to the testifying table, who will be the ones to testify, as opposed to the ones who are behind the scenes who are actually orchestrating the debate.
Sure. I mean, when you have truckers coming in and talking about the gas tax, when you have airlines coming in, that's a lot more It's more presentable to the American public than
people identify with, right? Other working people.
Sure.
We're talking to Nancy Watzman. She is project director of Cashing In. How can people get a hold of this information? First of all, your website. Do you remember the address?
We actually have a. Actually, what people should do is they should email us at info@crp.org. That's the best way to get a copy of the report.
Say it again.
info@crp.org. They can also call us, 202-857-0044.
And give that number again.
202-857-0044. And they can also use the mail. We can be reached at 1320 19th Street, Northwest, Suite 700, Washington, D.C., 2036.
How in the States have people been using this information? How can people actually get involved with grassroots organizing around this kind of information on what lobbyists are giving to which candidates, to which Congress members?
There are a number of ways to do that, and if people want, we have a brochure on various organizations around the country that are involved that we're happy to send out to people.
What do they do? What do people do around the country?
A whole variety of things. I mean, sometimes they might be getting the information out to their own local press. They might be writing letters to the editor. They might be, trying to do editorial board meetings. There's a whole variety of things that people can and are doing.
What is your assessment? Do you think there's any validity in the gas tax repeal debate to the idea that this is a regressive tax? People are forced to pay more money for gas, and that'll help people if there isn't such a high tax on gases.
Well, that's the substantive issues involved are, you know, perhaps debatable, but the question is what's being put forth and, you know, for whom? Who's really benefiting financially from these kinds of proposals?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see if the Republicans pick up on Dick Armey's suggestion that the education budget be cut to make up the difference that would result from a repeal of the gas tax. We will see what happens, and we'll certainly be following this debate throughout the week on Democracy Now! Nancy Watzman, thanks very much for joining us, Project Director of Cashing In of the Center for Responsive Politics. And this has been our segment on money in politics, which we try to bring you every Monday or almost every Monday on Democracy Now! This is a program that follows the elections. Tomorrow, by the way, are going to be the primaries in North Carolina. We're going to be bringing you information on that. Jesse Helms will be going up against one of the Democratic candidates tomorrow, Sanders or Gantt. We will see what happens with that, and we'll discuss the issues, particularly the racial issues, around the Democratic primary tomorrow in North Carolina. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about the Greens. We're going to be talking about Green Party politics in Germany and what we have to learn in this country from how they got organized and how they started running candidates for parliament two decades ago. After that, we'll be talking with a grassroots activist in Minnesota about money and politics and what grassroots activists can do. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here on Democracy Now!, and I'm joined in the studio by Helmut Lippelt. He's a founding member of the German Greens, who encouraged them to run a candidate for the European Parliament back in 1979. He's actually here in the United States, part of a delegation that has come to... Well, why don't you tell us about what you're asking for here?
Yes, you know, we are here on the invitation of the American Jewish Committee because there is this question of the leftover Nazi victims who are not recompensated in the eastern part of Europe. You know, the recompensation has been given in the Western world, but in eastern Germany only by bilateral treaties with Poland, with Russia, and so there are leftovers in the Baltics and things like that. And we are very pressuring our government very strong to have the Greens in Bonn. We are there a strong party, and we are pressuring to get this question solved on a wholesale, on a whole basis. And so we are here, made a seminary together with the American Jewish Committee, and brought these things to the American public.
And who would these Jewish victims of the Nazis be compensated by?
Of course, they have to be compensated by our government. But if they live in, for example, in the Baltics, in Lithuania, or countries like that, then there hasn't been a bilateral treaty. And bureaucratic is always, when money is scarce, and it is scarce in Germany. So they are always looking for excuses. And I think that is a question of so high moral obligation that you can't handle this with bureaucratic measures. And so we brought pressure open, because next week our foreign minister will be here. 2 weeks later, our chancellor will be here, and so the Americans may press them also.
Well, let's go back and talk about your story and how the German Greens did get founded. Certainly of interest to people in this country as the Greens try to organize around the United States. What happened in the 1970s?
In the 70s, there was this problem. There happened growing consciousness about the dangers of nuclear energy. And especially in the northern part of Germany, I'm coming from Lower Saxony, there was a plan to build a big reprocessing plant. And we were very much educated to the dangers of this. And so we tried with quite a lot of pressure groups, of grassroots groups, to convince the governing parties and the parties at all that that didn't make any sense and that the future of our country was at risk. And, well, there was a moment when the Lower Saxonian Prime Minister invited us for a so-called citizens' dialogue, and we asked for security reports, and he said, well, there they are standing at the wall, and we asked to look into this report. He said, I will give you half an hour. We asked for a copy machine. He said, no, no, not to copy. And then we went out, walked out, and said, well, they only understand the language of power, so we have to organize to go to elections so that they understand more because we are organizing. And that went very well. 78, we were very much astonished. We got 3.9, and so we got kickbacks because we have a law of recompensation for election expenses. And with that, and with a system of regional elections in Germany, so we grew with every regional election.
Now, let me ask you, at the time, were you dealing with what third parties deal with in this country?
Yeah.
The Greens right now, Ralph Nader, for example, running in California, tremendous pressure to say, if you do this, you will take votes away from a candidate who's more sympathetic to your cause. You'll take votes away from the Democrats, for example. At the time in the 1970s, were they saying this to you?
Of course, even it was a calculation in Lower Saxony by the Christian Democrat government. This Christian Democrat government had come into power only by secret ballot because some defectors of the Social Democrats in the secret ballot supported the candidate of the opposite party because they were not satisfied with their own. And so they had a hidden majority, only possible to vote the prime minister, but they couldn't make any laws. So there was the calculation, how shall we get with the next election an open majority? And so what we found out later, they were quite sympathetic to us because they said, well, if there is coming an environmental movement, they will take away 2/3 from the opposition and only 1/3 because we are conservative-minded and industrial-minded. So from us, they will not defect so many people. They will defect there. So they secretly, we found out later, not in when we started, secretly supported us. And later on, when we found out, well, we were grown up and I think you can't take such considerations that you have to support the not so worse party because you
what
see
what we call the lesser of two evils.
And you see in this country, as far as I understand, we were very much enthusiastic about Al Gore becoming vice president, but now if we see the balance, it's not what it should have been. So, of course, you always have this, but you can't make yourself dependent from calculations of the traditional political system.
Is money as much an issue in Germany in electoral politics as it is here? I mean, you're saying Gore
didn't turn. No, not to that degree. We have an election law. And there we get official money kickbacks after the success in proportion to the success. And when we got the first start, you know, the money was sufficient, which was publicly by law. Mm-hmm.
Are corporations allowed to give as much money as they do in this
country? No, they are not allowed in our country. They have limits. They have limits, and they have to publish what they are giving. And, of course, big companies gave to all parties to have always their influence in. And then there was, they were a bit, we had scandals about that because they were eager to have a tax relaxation. And that, of course, was not allowed by law, and so we had some scandals about that. And now they are very cautious.
Do the German Greens accept corporate money?
If we do get it and we can publish it, of course we accept. And you know, we have a growing industry, environmental industry. It's growing in a high degree. We have already 500,000 more people with jobs in that industry. And of course, there are some sympathetic enterprises which a bit support us also. But it has to be taxed and it has to be published, and we do that.
How many Greens are in Parliament? What's the percentage?
In the federal parliament, we are now the third strongest party. We are there with 49 members, more than the Liberals of the Kinkel and Genscher party. And in percentage, it means 8.2. But on the regional level, we are now standing around 15% in some regions.
Mm-hmm. Now, when Germany unified East and West, this was a great blow to the Green Party. Yeah. What happened there?
The problem is, you know, in the whole of Eastern Europe, the questions of economic survival is very much in the forefront. People, when the reconstruction of industry went forward, the question, do I save my job, was very much in the forefront. And so there is a bit the feeling of job secureness first. And the second thing is, because the reforms are not going as good as people expected, because of that, there is disappointment. And so the modernized communists are coming back in Poland and otherwise. And I think we have to go through to this period. And of course, in the Eastern Germany, the Greens are not as strong as in the Western Germany, but we are holding them. And of course, the society will get similar to our society, and we will march on.
How successful are the Greens right now in Germany? What are your priorities? What are you pushing for?
Look, we are now in, we have this federal system. We have 16 regional governments, and we are in coalitions in four of them. And the most urgent question, of course, as to principle, is to stop the nuclear energy industry. And that is not so easy because they are allowed to produce, and you can't revoke their licenses as quickly as you should. So it's a long, enduring fight.
So for what, like 16 years now, 17 years, you've been fighting the nuclear industry.
Yeah,
have you made any headway?
It depends. We hope that we will arrive on the federal level. Then, of course, we can make laws with which we can overcome these legal hindrances. The second question, of course, is always traffic. We always get into clashes when we say no more autoroutes in Germany because climate consequences and things like that. There we have clashes everywhere.
The highway lobby is very powerful in the United States as well.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. And of course, there are quite a lot of other, you see, the cow disease, so natural agriculture and things like that. We are on a broad range of issues in confronting the conventional wisdom.
We're talking to Helmut Lippert, who is one of the founding members of the German Greens, was the person who encouraged them to run a candidate for the European Parliament back in 1979. What about your trip here to the United States right now, as you look around at the political landscape here, do you have advice to give to the Greens? Do you think it's hopeless? Were you in the same position that Greens were here 20 years ago?
Now, look, when I was here half a year ago and I got to know this third party's congresses, and I was looking all this Greens of Pennsylvania, Greens of Utah, Greens of things like that. And then in between New Left and in between statehood parties. When I understood what this was all about, I found very much familiar, because it was a way we had started also. We were big collection of grassroots movements also. But of course, in America, you have this election system, which is not so much in their favor. But on the other hand, I understand that the way of environmental movements is here a way more of lobbying, and there you will always get to the fringe where you can't influence more. And of course, then the idea to get a third party's movement going is a good idea.
What do you mean? You're saying here the way is more to lobby than to do grassroots organizing?
I understood. I'm not so much acquainted with it, but I understood always when I was speaking to the Sierra Club or things like that, that they are very much eager to lobby on both great parties. But I think there will always be a given line which they can't cross.
Isn't there a fundamental difference between U.S. elections and German elections, politics, electoral politics, in terms of proportional representation?
Look, we have the 5% requirement and proportional representation.
Which means?
Means you have to get 5% of the votes to be represented in parliament, and that was very healthy, because you can't be too small. You have to collect. You are standing under the stress to combine, and that is a very healthy stress. If you come across this frontier, then of course you are in the game. And I think that this is a system which encourages new parties who are bringing forward new ideas to bring this through to the system.
But can you explain how it works? Because this will sound very alien to most people in the United States. When you say 5%, you mean people running for national election, they just have to get 5% of the vote, and then they're represented in parliament?
No, not the people. we are running as persons, but we are backed up with a list. So if I'm running and I'm getting 7%, or 10%, or 20. That's not enough to be the victor in the district. But then we have the list, and in this list, I am figuring perhaps as a second or the third on this list. And then, what the party gets together in comparison to the other parties, that is calculated, and then they said, well, the parliament is 500 seats, so you have to have 7%, so that means you have to have so many representants, and then they are taken from the list.
So your party decides who will actually be represented in parliament.
The party decides by a democratic putting up the list. The list is with election, of course, in the party.
We have to wrap up, but I want to ask, since you're here, about advice you would give to the Green Party right now in the United States and what you think of the candidate the Green Party is running, consumer advocate Ralph Nader.
No, I understand. I read in German papers, and of course I'm reading the International Herald Tribune, and so I know there is some fear that perhaps in California he may get some votes away from Clinton, more from them, from him than from Dole, and that may endanger the composition of the electoral Congress later on. Well, that is as life goes. You have always to stand against such calculations, and you have always to stand for your issues. And if Ralph Nader gets as much as I hope he will get, then Al Gore hasn't been good enough, and a new party has to come slowly in the system. That's the way. It's better than to get a revolution. Try in the system itself, and that is the way the system gives.
So is it true you're coming here to see President Clinton and Dole? They have both invited you into their offices.
No, of course not.
Well, I thank you very much at least for coming to visit our studios here at Pacifica. Helmut Lippelt has joined us. He is a founding member of the German Greens. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, the election show that asks questions the corporate media won't. And by the way, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us, leave a comment, and we'll be playing them throughout these next weeks on the show. You can call us at 202-588-0988, extension 313. You just have to say your name and where you're from and what you want to say, what comment you've got. That's 202-588-0988, extension 313. As part of Democracy Now!'s continuing presentation of progressive political activists and their work, we go today to Minnesota, where Alexa Bradley is program associate at MAPA, the Minnesota Alliance for Progressive Action, a coalition of 23 labor unions and community organizations working for social change. She spoke recently in St. Paul, Minnesota, with Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky.
When you met last November and you had your most recent board meetings, how did you relate to the fact that 1996 was a presidential election year?
Well, MAP itself is nonpartisan, and we're a 501c3 and 501c4. There's two organizations, so we don't actually get into partisan politics. But obviously, we're very, very concerned with the advancement of progressive issues and concerned with the political climate in the state and in the country. And we're looking for opportunities for progressive organizing, looking at actually some of the things that have happened on the right as possible opportunities for the left. For instance, Pat Buchanan coming out and being one of the few national figures to really talk about some of the things that are happening with large corporate abuses of people, of workers, and to really talk about corporate welfare and to talk about the layoffs and talk about the multinational situation. So we see there's some opportunities there because we agree with some of his analysis of the problem. We have a very different set of solutions, obviously.
When you say to talk about it, who are you talking to and how do you talk to them?
Good question. We I guess we have several different audiences. There are there's the board representatives themselves, who are the leaders, that then are liaisons back to the member organizations, and we try to keep a very active dialogue there between, so that it's a real coalition, not a paper coalition. There's a lot of involvement in MAPA. It's not just a list of groups with a staff somewhere. We have a newsletter that goes out quarterly that goes out to many, many people that are members of the different organizations. We also make a very strong commitment to do intensive education work and some sort of what we think of as broadcast educational work. The broadcast stuff is using any media opportunity we can and creating some of them to talk about the issues as we see them and the solutions as we see them and raise questions we think are important. And that ranges from very grassroots media, cable TV shows and local radio shows, to trying to get on some of the more mainstream media outlets. We also have developed a series of workshops, which are more intensive, which we offer. They're usually about 2 hours, which are very participatory in nature and engage people with actively thinking about a set of issues and linking them to the experiences in their lives.
As you came into 1996, what issues in Minnesota do you find are having the greatest resonance, the ones that when you do your outreach and try to talk to people, their eyes light up and they say, yeah.
The two issues that I would say are the ones that people here have resonated to are issues that relate to economic justice and, you know, disparity of wealth and income and concentration of wealth and economic insecurity, that whole arena of issues around economic justice. And the other is environmental issues. Minnesota has a very strong history, maybe it's the Scandinavians, I'm not sure which, of environmental concern and protection, and that's beginning to be eroded as the Twin Cities vastly expands and grows. I think it's growing, one of the fastest growing cities in the, you know, areas in the country. And a lot of concern about what that impact on the environment is.
How bought and paid for would you say the Minnesota State Legislature is on questions like that? Are there people there who actually make judgments that don't have to do with their campaign contributions?
You know, I can give two different answers to that question. I can give the answer which is relative to other states. When, you know, some of the Washington, D.C.-based think tanks take a look at big money in politics, Minnesota comes out relatively better than many states. We have some very good campaign finance laws, et cetera. However, when you get right down in there, and we just finished a report on money in politics, there's a significant impact of large contributors and you know, special interests, largely business interests, on the Minnesota legislature.
Well, take an issue that you really want to lobby about from a progressive point of view, your alliance, and tell our listeners around the country, if you can, what happens when you go to St. Paul, to the state capitol. How do you speak to them if the dollars are speaking one way? How do you try to speak a different language or the same language in a different dialect?
Basically, our analysis of working at the legislature is there's two kinds of power. There's organized money and there's organized people. And obviously, we're not going to be organized money. We're trying to be organized people. And so one of the things we always are working on is educating, organizing, mobilizing people around issues. An issue we worked on just recently, which felt, and it actually is an ongoing issue, is the issue of nuclear waste storage on the banks of the Mississippi. MAPA was very, very involved in that effort 2 years ago to completely stop the additional storage. And that's when where big money clearly won out, that we actually spent more money than we've ever spent on anything. We raised more money because there was such a lot of concern in Minnesota about this.
What kind of money are we talking about here?
We spent in that campaign, I want to say $150,000. And typically, I mean, MAPA's entire budget for a year is about $250,000. So typically, we spend several thousand dollars in a legislative session. You know, we don't do perks, gifts, you know, any of that stuff, campaign contributions. We're working with organized people. We do phone banks. We do, you know, lobby days with people. We organize, you know, action alerts. We do have two people over there that lobby. Myself and Mel Duncan. And so we try to go beyond just sort of the moral merits of an issue to having some power behind that of constituent power. We do targeted education in districts where we feel like that we can have the most impact.
You say you lost that one about the storing of the waste on the banks of the Mississippi. How did that come down?
That was one of the most bitter defeats we've ever had here, and certainly I personally felt that. Essentially, it came down to the money versus people, and money won out. In fact, at one point, a DFL, a Democratic legislator, said to us, if you all win, being the environmentalists and the tribe and others, you're going to have to make up $50,000 of contributions to the DFL caucus. Now, what that means is that NSP is giving money to the DFL caucus.
Northern States Power.
Northern States Power, the power plant that wanted to store the nuclear waste in these large casks right on the banks of the Mississippi and about three blocks from an Indian reservation with a substantial population. And they make such substantial contributions, not just to individual candidates, but to the entire Democratic caucus, and that there was a very clear link drawn there that the DFL was not willing to totally alienate the power company for fear of losing those contributions.
How do you relate to the rest of the state of Minnesota? I think this is important because so many progressive organizations are located in the relatively tolerant, relatively liberal city centers.
There is, in rural Minnesota, particularly on economic issues, there is a progressive voice. I don't know that all of the people would call themselves, quote, progressive, but that when we've worked on economic justice issues, where we've worked on tax fairness, where we've worked on corporate welfare, we've talked about those issues in the public, we've actually gotten a very good reception. There's parts of the state that are more conservative, and certainly there's a growing, right wing in the Republican Party and general in Minnesota. On social issues, there is much more division in the state. It's a state that has a strong pro-life faction. But we were able to pass, for instance, a gay rights bill in the state with both bipartisan support and significant rural support. So, it's a funny state in that sense, but there is progressive community and activists around the entire state.
Looked at from outside the state of Minnesota, when people think of the politics of this state, especially people on the left side of the political spectrum, they think of Paul Wellstone, who looks to some of the rest of the country to be a very progressive legislator. But my experience with all legislators is that, viewed from inside the state, sometimes the view is more nuanced, to say the least. How does he look to you now as he's coming up for his re-election bid in 1996?
Well, personally, and again, MAPA doesn't have any position on candidates, but many people that we work with are still very enamored with Paul Wellstone. We were very clear when he was elected, and many of us worked in his campaign, that we knew we would still have to push him, that he wasn't just going to be our knight in shiny armor and we could all go home and just be glad he was there. And in fact, I think probably a few weeks into his term, I'm trying to remember, maybe it was the Gulf War, and there were people that worked very hard for him that were ardently opposed to any U.S. intervention whatsoever in any kind of conflict in the world. And he actually was, to them, a sellout on that issue, in that he supported it to any degree whatsoever. And so there were people picketing and rallying outside of his office right there 3 weeks later. And so I think there's a very healthy relationship there where we support him. We think he's, a wonderful senator and has done just, fabulous things, as much as you can in that context. And yet we also recognize that our role with him is to continue to be the voice pushing for more progressive work and to keep him accountable to that.
He's going to need you, not as MAPA, which is a tax-exempt organization, so can't lobby, but I would assume that many of your membership is interested in seeing him reelected. He's going to need your troops out in the streets. There was quite a movement, as I recall, in 1990 when he was first elected to turn out people who would work on his campaign. Do you think there's going to be that much enthusiasm for him in 1996?
I think we're already seeing it. When people look out if people look at the other U.S. senator from Minnesota, which is, sort of the other end of the spectrum, everyone is very, that I work with is very afraid that we'll have another kind of Newt Gingrich clone in that seat. We can't afford that. And Paul Wellstone is a deeply committed. He's a grassroots person. He understands real people's issues. He's not just a good vote, kind of a bureaucratic Democrat. He's someone that really comes out of grassroots struggles, and I don't think we could do better. And so I think I've already seen, being over to his campaign office a few times, just the enthusiasm and excitement and the fundraising. I mean, he's able to raise money in a way that from small contributors, that's actually showing, you know, pretty remarkable ability to get that out of the grassroots.
What did you do about corporate welfare? You had a big campaign last year, and I understand you have another one this year. This is a phrase that comes up a lot in Washington: let's get rid of corporate welfare. And it's even a little bit bipartisan sometimes. There are some Republicans who say that too. We can't cure human welfare at the same time still give away tens of millions of dollars to corporations. People, I think, would be interested in how you handle that in Minnesota.
Well, we've had also bipartisan support here for that idea. We actually got onto the issue of corporate welfare almost by accident or grace or serendipity or something. We, like elsewhere, there have been a lot of focus on welfare reform for low-income families. And we thought, well, you know, wouldn't it be hilarious if they put a CEO who was receiving some kind of subsidy through the same kind of hoops that they did for, you know, a low-income mom? And we were going to do just a little skit at the Capitol and put a bunch of people dressed as CEOs through that, you know, hoops, asking about their budgeting. Did they buy cigarettes? You know, were they married and why not? And then suddenly we realized, as we began to dig into it in preparation for this little satiric piece, that there was really a very serious public policy issue. That posed a lot of questions about accountability of public funds and, you know, comparison of budget priorities. And so at that point, we proposed legislation that we did some research that identified what we could of corporate welfare in Minnesota. And at that point, we identified about $1 billion a year in Minnesota, which is a lot. Our state budget for a year is about $8 billion. And it's in tax breaks, and it's in, you know, all kinds of slush funds here and there, and grants and loans. And we proposed a bill that said if a business receiving over $25,000 would have to set wage and job goals and actually meet them in 2 years. And initially in the bill, we had a wage requirement that said if you received a subsidy like that, you had to pay at least the equivalent of the poverty level for a family of four, which is about, was then and $7.21 an hour. We lost that part of the bill, the wage requirement. We got the part about setting the job and wage goals and having to meet them and within the 2 years, or having to pay the assistance back. And a number of other provisions relating to, you know, analyzing various tax breaks for their effectiveness.
The governor signed this?
He did.
The Republican governor?
The Republican governor, yes. In fact, that's how we lost the wage requirement, that he was okay with it up to that point and didn't like the wage requirement. We're back again this year with the wage requirement. We feel, after more extensive research, that this is even more needed, that there are all kinds of public subsidies going to building McDonald's, where people are being paid $5 an hour, and Super America, which is a gas station, you know, a good chain in Minnesota, and, you know, all of the sort of strip mall development is being funded by tax increment financing and other forms of public subsidy, and then people are being paid in those jobs at very low wages. And what's the benefit to the community? I mean, you know, we subsidize Super America, but who benefits from that?
You say you're back this year. What is your legislation trying to accomplish this year, and where is it at in the Minnesota State Legislature?
Very simply, we want businesses receiving, again, over $25,000 worth of bonds, tax increment financing, loans and grants, either a local level or a state level, for any jobs they create with the assistance, that they would have to pay at least $7.28 an hour, which is now the equivalent of the poverty level for a family of four. And if they fail to pay that they would pay a penalty of twice the difference that they're, you know, between what they are paying and what they would pay to the local human service agency, with the idea being that anyone who's being paid below the poverty level would probably qualify for assistance, and that the taxpayer should not be subsidizing twice. You know, we're subsidizing the business and then, again, that family that can't make a living on the wage they're getting.
Alexa Bradley is Program Associate of the Minnesota Alliance for Progressive Action in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I'm Larry Bensky in St. Paul, Minnesota for Pacifica Radio.
And thank you, Larry, for that. For more information about the Minnesota Alliance for Progressive Action, you can contact them at 612-641-4150. That's 612-641-4050. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, the North Carolina Democratic primary, Harvey Gantt versus Charles Sanders, who will run against North Carolina Republican Senator Jesse Helms. And why Kathy Lee Gifford is crying. We'll talk with Charlie Kernighan, who's been exposing U.S. corporate investment in Central America for years. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield. Kenneth Mason is our engineer. If you'd like a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We look forward to hearing from you. I'm Amy Goodman. Join us tomorrow for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!